It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, more than 100 people in Wisconsin have been sickened by the foodborne parasite Cyclospora. We'll find out what we know about the outbreak and how we can stay healthy. First, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled 5-4 to uphold President Trump's travel ban. This is the third version of the ban that barred travelers from 8 countries, 6 of which have majority Muslim populations. Here's President Trump reacting to the news earlier today at the White House.
We want a system where when people come in illegally, they have to go out. And a nice, simple system that works. You know, Mexico holds people for 4 hours.
A different clip than we had planned there. Challengers had argued that the ban was unconstitutionally discriminating against travelers based on their religious beliefs, citing Trump's campaign comments calling for a Muslim ban. Kimmy King is a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back.
Well, in terms of immediate impacts, before we dig into the ruling, what does this mean for people from the countries listed in the proclamation to travel to the United States?
So remember that each of the different countries have different bans put in place. So it depends in part where you're coming from. But say, for example, Iran, one of the ones that we're typically going after, it suspends entry to Iranians as immigrants and non-immigrants. But if you have a valid student and exchange visitor visa, you can enter, but you've got to go through enhanced screening. Whereas like North Korea suspends entry to North Koreans as immigrants and non-immigrants, period, flat, the end. So it's going to mean different things according to what the president set up under the ban as it was revised when it went into its third iteration.
There's a 5-4 vote here. What was the argument from the majority here, Kimmy?
So most people are saying today that the Roberts Court has basically, you know, bowed to presidential power without bowing to President Trump, and that in some ways they've ignored the fact that Trump is the president, because when you look at Roberts' opinion, he casts this in terms of executive authority. And the scholars have pointed out, has correctly pointed out, that the president has broad deference when it comes to immigration. And in fact, Congress has given him even more power under the Immigration and Nationality Act. And so it's really more about the process than it is about the person.
And the minority in the court, a very forceful dissent, I understand, they were coming at this from a different angle.
They are furious. And to read the dissent, and when you read through the dissents, you will see that they are most angry about the majority not focusing in on the statements that President Trump made. Remember, this original travel ban has gone through, it was in its third iteration after having been struck down by lower courts. And so what they point to are all of the statements made by the president fairly early on in the implementation of the travel ban, or an attempt to put it in place, in which he has this very extreme anti-Muslim rhetoric. As a result of the federal court decisions, he had to go back, and they did a 200-country review of who was a threat and who was not. You know, Chad had originally been on the list, and then Chad got taken off. And so the question that the majority said was, well, can we attribute these statements out of the president to the intent behind why the law was created? And the court said, absolutely not. We just look at executive authority and power to do so, and the president has it. So in that sense, they narrowed the ruling, and you see Justice Kennedy and his concurrence, because he was a swing voter. Kennedy makes very clear that we need to be careful about how these things are applied. And so that's almost his way of saying the court will be watching.
It seems like there's two different arguments going on here. The majority says this is an executive authority issue. The minority says this is a religious discrimination issue. Do I have that right?
You absolutely have that right. And welcome to polarization in American politics. There is a way in which there are two different groups of people seeing issues as they are playing themselves out. And we are seeing that now play out inside the institutions as well. Just as people are polarized, the institutions are polarized. You see that in a number of decisions that have come down this term out of the court since Justice Gorsuch has been added.
Now, you mentioned Justice Kennedy saying, okay, yes, you can do this, but be careful about how you do that. Now, does that little caveat there open the door to a potential future challenge, depending on how this is implemented?
Absolutely. And there is a rare court ruling that does not leave open a challenge. And you betcha there are going to be challenges all over the place. But it does leave open because this is, in essence, a facial challenge. That is, on its face, does the law in some way discriminate or target persons for an unlawful reason? And if it's a protected group, like a religious or a group or a minority group, you get a heightened level of scrutiny out of the court. What the court said is that this is just not about discrimination in this context. It's about whether the president has a legit, you know, has shown a legitimate interest. Is there a rational basis? Could he have rationally concluded that putting this ban in place protects the national security interests? And the court, in its 5-4, said yes. And Anthony said, yeah, on its face, but keep an eye out.
Kimmy King is with us, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, talking about the Supreme Court decision on the travel ban. We heard via email from Matt in Wausau. Matt says, every 5-4 ideological decision by the Supreme Court is a blow to democracy. Denying a popular vote winning 2-time president the appointment of a justice flies in the face of majority rule. And Kimmy, on a bigger issue, a lot of people have been talking about this ruling and others. 5-4 majorities might have gone very differently if we had Merrick Garland, Barack Obama's nominee, instead of Neil Gorsuch.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that your caller is picking up on is the fact that as much as people are talking about this as a Trump victory, it is fundamentally a McConnell victory. And the ability of McConnell to hold the line on that Gorsuch appointment has been absolutely critical, whether you're looking at gerrymandering cases or travel bans. So it will be curious to see how this plays itself out. I would be, you know, remiss if I didn't point out that there's much scuttlebutt today that Kennedy will step down at the end of this term. And so while Kennedy has been a moderate swing voter, he doesn't always go the way the liberals like, nor the way the conservatives like. It's going to be a dogfight on the appointment over Kennedy.
Right. People have been pointing toward a fairly serene approval process for Neil Gorsuch as these things go, and wondering, hey, do Democrats, after seeing the outcome of Gorsuch on the court, do they put up a bigger fight to, this is all hypothetical, Justice Kennedy's still there, but to Justice Kennedy's successor?
Oh, yeah. And there's just going to continue to be fights no matter what. Kennedy would not. I mean, we'll see what happens with Kennedy, whether he would resign before the midterms. And that would throw everything off because then, of course, the midterm results would come into play. It will be interesting to see what happens as we move through the summer with the primaries because increasingly everything has become a political polarization and everything has become imbued with this political rhetoric and hype with everyone being so attached to their political preferences.
We've talked about this before a little bit, Kimmy. Do the courts have an outsized role in our politics? Is that the biggest issue now when people are voting, especially for a U.S. senator and president, of course? What's going to happen in the courts?
I think that they're absolutely staking much more on the line, but I would argue that that's been going on since the 1980s and that we saw with a number of the appointments by Ronald Reagan when he pushed harder for ideology litmus tests that you started to see ideology play itself out more. Don't forget that Chief Justice John Roberts, one of the reasons why he was considered to be a favorite to become a Chief Justice by Bush is because he was thought to promote presidential authority, that if you look at some of his lower court rulings, he was in favor of presidential authority. And so that, I think, is another thing to keep in mind as you look at these Supreme Court appointments.
Has that gone both ways? Is a court justice deferential to presidential authority, deferential whether it's a Republican who appointed them or a Democrat who didn't?
It's interesting because every single justice is different and justices will vacillate over the course of their lifetime, right? One of the things that's curious about what Chief Justice John Roberts said regarding the Trump travel ban is he made it very clear that this was in no way a determination about, quote, the soundness of the policy, which most people are interpreting that as his slap on, look, I'm giving you the presidential power, but let's be clear, I'm not so sure that you're using it the right way. And so over time, there is some indication that there are some justices who back off of some of their opinions. So we'll see what happens with Roberts. Don't forget, he's the one who voted to allow Obamacare to be upheld. And it's for that reason that it was allowed to go forward under the Obama administration, thanks to Chief Justice John Roberts.
Does this court ruling empower the president and the White House on whatever their next step might be on an immigration issue?
I think the real question is there anything that doesn't empower the Trump White House? I think that there is no doubt today that in a series of rulings, that whether you're looking at the gerrymander in Texas or you're looking at the pro-life, anti-choice, however you want to view it, decision out in California, or you're looking at the Trump travel ban, that there are going to continue to be these moments of claimed victory that definitely indicate that the courts are allowing part of President Trump's agenda to go forward.
We'll leave it there. Kimmy, thanks for joining us today.
You betcha. Take care. Love Public Radio.
That's Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas. She was with us to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision released today to uphold President Trump's travel ban, the third version of that ban. A 5-4 conservative majority ruled with the White House on this one. Right now, an outbreak of the foodborne parasite Cyclospora has infected people from 4 states, and Wisconsin is being hit the hardest. Health officials have confirmed more than 140 cases of cyclosporiasis. The infections are traced to contaminated Del Monte vegetable trays sold at Quick Trip stores around the state. Del Monte issued a recall for those trays on June 8th. Ryan Wozniak is the Surveillance and Investigation Unit Supervisor with the Bureau of Communicable Diseases at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Well, before we get into the basics of Cyclospora, can you give us a sense of where we are in Wisconsin? It seems like, just from press reports, that it peaked a week or so ago. Are we still seeing new cases?
Yeah, we are still seeing new cases. The number of new cases per day has gone down a bit. And as you know, this is an ongoing investigation, so we are seeing additional cases each day. But currently, and this can be viewed on our website, which you can find at, if you search DHS outbreaks. DHS is for our agency, the Department of Health Services. Our current numbers in Wisconsin related to this outbreak of cyclosporiasis, we have interviewed 133 potential cases, and 122 of those have reported exposure to veggie trays purchased at a Quick Trip location.
Is this concentrated in a part or parts of the state?
No, we're seeing kind of a broad distribution, as would be expected, based on location of these stores across Wisconsin.
Well, tell us a little bit about Cyclospora and the disease it causes. This is a bacteria, right?
Actually, it's a parasite.
A parasite, okay.
That is found in human or primate feces. Often it is spread, not person to person, but is spread when people ingest food or water that is contaminated with human feces or poop. We do not see it. It's not endemic to the U.S. generally. We see it often in other tropical or subtropical countries where we may import produce or usually just it's produce, vegetables, and fruit from other countries that are in subtropical or tropical regions.
So Americans might encounter this, like when you go traveling and people say don't eat the raw vegetables. This is one of the illnesses why we wouldn't want to do that?
Correct. Yep. So it's a travel-related disease, but we also get it when we import produce from these regions.
Let's talk a little bit about the symptoms. If I have this, what am I feeling like?
This is an intestinal parasite that attacks the intestines, so you're going to have potentially frequent watery diarrhea, loss of appetite, stomach cramps, bloating, increased gas, nausea, and fatigue, potentially.
Now, as foodborne illnesses go, nobody wants any of them, but mm-hmm. This isn't one of the more dangerous ones. Do I have that right?
Well, yeah, typically cause fatalities, but it could possibly. They're all potentially dangerous, but I would say this is not maybe our most dangerous foodborne illness.
What kind of treatment is there if someone's diagnosed with this?
The most common treatment that is prescribed, it's a combination antibiotic. It's known as Bactrim, Septra, or Cotrim. It contains the antibiotics trimethoprim and sulfamethoxazole. Those are sulfamethoxazole is a sulfonamide antibiotic. Some people do have allergic reactions to that particular drug, so they should consult with their physician if they have that allergy.
Right, I do, for example. Mm-hmm. I know it's pretty common. Is there a plan B if you can't take the sulfa?
There are some other antibiotics that have shown some efficacy. Those are listed on the CDC website and can also be found on our website. There haven't been a lot that have been tested extensively and shown efficacy in these against this parasite. But there are some reports of some level of efficacy.
Talking to Ryan Wozniak with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services about this outbreak of cyclospora infections from veggie trays purchased in Wisconsin. Ryan, let's get back to those veggie trays. Mm-hmm. As far as we know, the contaminated ones, are they out of the system, off the market?
Yes, they were voluntarily recalled when we first started to see a trend here and common exposures among these products.
Now, if I'm shopping, I'm looking at a veggie tray or a vegetable, I'm not going to see anything different about something contaminated with cyclospora, am I?
No, not to the naked eye. You won't notice any difference.
Is there anything a consumer can do? I've been reading rinsing isn't, mm-hmm. and I don't know that everybody rinses their veggie trays anyway. Rinsing
right.
isn't going to help, right?
Yeah, we always recommend rinsing raw produce or cooking it. Also, if you can't cook it, peel it or wash it in safe water. Do not eat it. You know, we always recommend washing hands also before preparing any food. And as I mentioned, washing fruits and vegetables and scrubbing those that have thicker skins. And also, you should be washing your cutting boards, dishes, utensils, and countertops with soap and hot water, too, to prevent the spread of bacteria or other parasites that may be found on produce.
Right. That's always a good practice, not just for cyclospora, but cyclospora is kind of resistant. Rinsing it doesn't necessarily stop it. Is that right?
Well, it helps, but yes, it doesn't necessarily kill. It doesn't kill the parasite completely, but it will significantly reduce the amount that might be present on a surface.
Seems like the best bet would be to not have cyclospora in the produce at the mm-hmm. source, I guess. Is there anything we can do to prevent that?
Well, you know, that's something that, you know, we don't have a role in that as much. It's mostly the Food and Drug Administration that tracks the distribution chain of these materials. And also we have within Wisconsin, the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection that traces back sources of food that may contain contaminants like this. Aside from kind of knowing where your produce is grown, and like I said, for cyclosporiasis at least, or cyclospora, the parasite, it is not endemic to the U.S. So if you eat more local vegetables, that would protect you from this particular parasite, but not potentially other bacteria or parasites that are endemic to the U.S.
I want to take a step back on foodborne illness because, you know, this time it was veggie trays that's been mm-hmm. cantaloupe in the past or romaine lettuce. Can you tell us what kind of detection and warning system is in place here in Wisconsin to spot these things and get the word out?
Sure. Yeah. So we have a pretty robust surveillance system in Wisconsin, and most other states do as well. We, at the state level, we work with our local health departments and labs and clinicians to get the word out. So, for example, we typically, when we get reports of lab positive stool specimens, for example, that come in through our electronic disease reporting system. And once we have positive results, we work with our local health departments and to interview folks that have been tested as positive to get exposure histories for them. And based on that, we look to see if we can identify any commonalities. And once we start to see potentially common exposures, we usually generate an additional follow-up questionnaire to gain more information. And then slowly, it takes usually a couple weeks or so to process all this information. And then we start to see, if we do start to see some commonalities, we start working with our other partners at the Department of Ag, Trade and Consumer Protection, and FDA and CDC, if it's a multi-state outbreak, to try to trace back where the sources may have been of these products and to try to get them off the shelves.
How big a problem is it for you in this kind of work for stuff going on under the radar? Somebody gets this, thinks, oh, I must have ate something bad. It's not bad enough to go to the doctor.
Yeah, it does depend on the severity of the illness, and there are certainly a number of cases each year that we aren't necessarily able to tie to a particular exposure, or if folks do not go and get tested, we don't necessarily find out about it. So, we can only count and track those cases of folks that have seen a physician and been tested.
And what's the best way for consumers to keep track of recalled foods in case they already have it in their fridge?
Yeah. That's another good question. The FDA website has usually a list of recalls. For specific outbreaks, we'll have that also on our website. And CDC also, if it's a multi-state outbreak, we'll have that information on their website as well.
We'll leave it there, Ryan. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having us.
Ryan Wozniak is a supervisor with the Bureau of Communicable Diseases at the Wisconsin Health Department. He was with us to talk about an outbreak of cyclospora in the state, caused by Del Monte vegetable trays sold at Quick Trip stores. First, you probably consume some form of media on a daily basis, a TV show, songs, an article online, a book you're reading. These things exist because somebody had an idea that they decided was worth the risk and time to pursue. But where do these ideas come from, and can we all add some creativity to our lives? Matt Richtel has written nonfiction, several thriller novels, a comic strip, and a children's book. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. He wrote a section on how to be creative for the New York Times series, A Year of Living Better. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today. Well, sometimes I think people think that creativity is left to the pros, the musician, the author, whatever. Do you want to make the case that we should all try to get a little more creativity in our daily lives?
Oh, I'm gonna see you and raise you, Rob. I don't need to make the case that people should. I think that they already are, and I think for the most part, it's in virtually everybody and often silenced. So, you got it in you, listener.
How is it silenced?
Well, I'm gonna be accused of being too touchy-feely here. I'll do it briefly.
Go for it.
But I think it gets silenced. I think creativity gets silenced very early in life because much of civility depends on us being uniform, and so lots of rules get stepped down. And I'm set down, and I'm a parent, and I can hear my own voice sometimes saying no to an idea that is really a form of creativity burst very childlike out of my kids. So let me put that another way: how do you get past the voice that you have inherited or internalized that says no all the time? Is that a good way to go at this?
No. Well, so talk about how we shut that voice down, though.
That's what I'm saying. I asked you a double negative. Forgive me.
That's okay.
So how do you shut that voice down? How do you hear the childlike utterances that are seedlings of creativity? Well, step back a touch. I mentioned everybody's got creativity in them. Creativity, what is it? What are we talking about here? Can I define it very broadly for a second?
Please do, yeah.
So I think of it, we're not just talking artistic. I'm talking, this is an argument for pragmatists and artists alike. This is the stuff of new businesses. It's the stuff of books. It's the stuff of songs. It's the stuff of cooking. It's the stuff of rethinking a relationship. Creativity is the stitching together in a new way of existing ideas or observations. And a lot of times, children are a nice place for it because they don't censor themselves, but they're also, you can't claim that they've got a ton of potential creativity in the moment because they don't have the experience or the ideas to synthesize. You listener, all of us have those things, but by contrast, you have begun to silence the free expression of those ideas. So, how do you silence that voice? Well, I'm going to use silence in a different way right now. There is in all of us, I mentioned these ideas, and where they appear and when they cross the horizon of our minds is often in very quiet times, and we have to be attuned to them. So, full stop at that. Does that make sense, that you've got these ideas floating through your brain, but you're not necessarily paying attention to them?
Well, definitely. I think everybody has that idle daydream maybe now and then, or if only I could blank sort of concept. Is that what you're talking about?
Very good, Rob. I'm talking about that. And I want to add one piece about why we don't listen to this. So those things happen in the silence, and there are two reasons for the most part. Most of us don't listen to those, and I speak only from a lot of experience. The first reason is that silence is scary as heck. So what we tend to do is, when the world gets quiet, we fill it with all kinds of things, from I know Angry Birds is old. What's the new Angry Birds? Fortnite, sure, yeah. Checking the Packers score, in my case, the San Francisco Giants, or whatever your thing is. But we fill it with busy things, and we're filling it both because there's an opportunity to fill it, but we also fill it because silence is scary, and we don't know what we're going to find there. And so the very first step in accessing your creativity is learning to live with a little bit of quiet and then watching what appears in that space. Making sense, not making sense.
Definitely making sense, Matt. I was talking to Matt Richtel about creativity, how to find it and harness it. Okay, so we make that space, Matt, and then we open ourselves up to these creative ideas that are floating around in our brain. How do we figure out, hey, this is one I like, this is one I want to chase, and put it into practice?
Totally. So this is hard for even those of us who are practiced at finding ideas everywhere. How do we decide? The first thing that I think many of your listeners already know, they might use different language than I, but many of them have already felt this. They're going to feel something in that silence that I think of as inspiration or muse. And the what helps determine whether to pursue that are two things. One is, how strong is the inspiration or the muse? There are times when I have a book or song idea that is so overpowering, I know it's going to be unavoidable. And there are times I have an idea that feels very exciting in the moment, and I also don't know whether I'm going to have the energy to pursue it, and so I write it down somewhere. And I can't offer you a guide beyond how powerful is the inspiration. Let me just ask you, Rob, can you tell in your own life, are you able to tell the difference between an inspiration that's thrilling and one that feels pretty good, but I'm not sure?
I definitely have had both of those, and I've had the one you talked about where the idea is brilliant when you have it, and on further review, as the referees say, it's less exciting.
Yes, you can go to the booth in New York.
Exactly.
But I want to caution something about this. I'm going to add another step to this. And I mentioned there's two pieces here. The problem with going to the replay booth is that it often introduces an idea that is the mortal enemy of all creativity, whether it's business, a business idea, an artistic idea, what have you. And the mortal foe of creativity is perfectionism. And what happens when people go to the replay booth, I love your metaphor, when they start second-guessing early enough on, it is possible to second-guess every great idea that ever happened. And you can just imagine antibiotics, cars, Thunder Road by Bruce Springsteen. Somewhere along the line, any of the creators could have said, I don't know if I can really do that the right way. So I would urge people to at least apply the imperfection test and allow the idea to live under the guise that it may well be imperfect and still be great.
I want to talk about our audience here, our perceived audience, Matt. Sometimes when we're talking about a creative thing, it might be, hey, I want to write a novel. I've got this great idea. The world's going to love it. I'm never going to do that. I do creativity in other ways, but it might be fun for me to write a short story just to write it. Can we embrace that creativity for an audience of maybe just ourselves?
Yes, I absolutely. And in fact, I tend to think that you don't really know if you're going to like the execution part until you attempt it. And execution and creativity are not the same things. I mean, it's so tired, I'm sorry to be using it in a conversation about creativity, but there's inspiration and perspiration, and all of them are part of execution of a creative idea. And so, particularly today with the internet, where you can put things out into the world, there is no harm, shame, downside. Pick your pejorative. There's no downside to trying that thing. And what you may discover along the way is that the execution is as enjoyable as the inspiration. And quite honestly, that's how you know you found your niche. It's when the inspiration, the excitement you feel over the muse, is as cool as the excitement you feel when you're doing that thing.
Okay, but I think a lot of people have probably been through that situation where they have the brilliant idea, the outcome is great, but there's that tough spot where it's hard work. Can you help us power through that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say two things. First of all, if it's really, really painful, I'm not sure you should be doing it. And I think that there's a and there's a difference between hard and really, really painful. But let me address really, really painful for a second. I run into all kinds of people who say to me, I want to write a book. And you know, I say, that's great. Tell me why you want to write a book. And when we really get down to why they want to write a book, it's because they want a book on the shelf. And that's very different than having the experience of writing a book or wanting to tell a story. And the people who experience the most pain in these creative processes are putting the end before the process. Does that group make sense for
Definitely.
A second?
Let me address the
really practical problem of pushing through things. I think that what people can do, and there's a whole conversation we could have over the long run, but there's times and places to pick your perspiration. For instance, I know in the myriad things that I write, there's a period of the day where I am clear-headed enough to execute with a level of pleasure that doesn't turn to frustration. So probably it's going to be hard to write in, you know, your van on your coffee break at a job that takes a lot of work. You're probably going to have to find some time where the execution feels less painful. And then you will know if that's something you actually enjoy doing. But, you know, I wouldn't ask you to try any new thing under a serious stress. That would make it painful by definition.
Talking to Matt Richtel, author, cartoonist, investigative reporter for the New York Times, talking about how to be creative and embrace that creativity, generate ideas, and make them happen. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How are you creative in leadership at work, building something, making something, writing something? Do you feel like you have that creative muse, or do you feel like you have that self-censorship process that, you know, you might have that idea and then you shut it down? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We are getting inspired to be more creative. Matt Richtel is with us, author, cartoonist, reporter for the New York Times. We're talking about where creative ideas come from and how to be more creative in our lives. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Does creativity play a role in your life? Do you wish it did play more of a role in your life? Where do your best ideas come from and how do you take them to fruition? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brandy wrote on Facebook, it comes on its own. It needn't be quiet or peaceful, loud or tumultuous. Sometimes it's a response to an article, sometimes an image I see. Sometimes it's nothing in particular and an idea enters my head. This is particularly useful when I have a paper to write. The idea always comes when it wants to. So Matt, Brandy has, it sounds like, kind of learned or trained herself to be receptive to the idea whenever it chooses to make an appearance.
Yes, but I want to address something really powerful I have learned in my own life, and that I've actually had to be a little bit careful about, is that sometimes when you start to hear this muse, as Brandy, you know, evidently has, it can actually become oddly detrimental when you allow it to become a procrastination technique. And here's what I mean by it. Because execution is less exciting often than inspiration, when you find yourself in a difficult period of execution, it can yield terrific inspiration. I have had to learn over time, I'm speaking only for myself, but I suspect this is more widespread, that to exhibit some discipline when the ideas pop up while I am engaged in other tasks, or even in the quiet moments when I am engaged in other tasks, and say, that one will have to wait. Don't let the muse dupe you. She is she's voracious.
So how do you, okay, so I want to write something or whatever, and the idea isn't there. How can I get myself in a habit of, making that idea come?
I think yes and no. I mean, I think it's, I think ideas often can't be forced. And I will go through periods where nothing comes to mind, and I have learned to let myself be still. And let me explain one reason why that is. I mentioned earlier that we synthesize a lot of information, and then that those things tend to come together in a creative burst. It may be that you have, for want of a better word, that you've sort of run low on material. And it needs to build back up. I think you have to have faith that that will happen. The one caveat is, it's very hard to say, I want to engage in this, you know, random medium. Let's say I wanted to start a business. I'm not a business person. I couldn't just say, I'm going to wait for an idea for a business, because I'm not steeped at all in the medium that I'm thinking about. I'm not sure you can will an idea in an area about which you know very little.
I want to bring on a caller now. Bismuth is with us in Bayfield. Hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about?
I wanted to ask about, I guess, when you get ideas in your mind and there's, like, all these different ideas, but then they each have their, like, certain boundaries that kind of, like, guide them. And I guess I tend to look at the boundaries first, rather than think about the ideas, and then that kind of like shuts the idea down, whether it's like
Can you give me a specific example?
Yes. Well, say you're thinking of I'm thinking of a research project, and then I have all these ideas, like these methods and like what I'm doing, what I'm going to use, and then I will think about the financial like cost of that. And then that's like, oh, that's like way out of my league, or like I need to find that, and it's hard to find like funding.
I gotcha. So you work within those constraints. And I'll throw another example. Maybe a composer says, okay, I need to compose something. I don't have the budget, or I don't want to do it for a full orchestra. I'm going to do a string quartet. And then that sets you on a path, having those boundaries in place, Matt.
Yeah, or I'll give an example from my own life. I write a lot of music, but... And I envision a band that I don't have total control over, and so I have to put those pieces together, and it's very limiting given that I write on keyboard. I appreciate what the caller is saying. That is a really, really good question. What do you do when your idea exceeds the scope of the resources you have? Is that a fair way to put that?
I think so, yeah.
I mean... The truth is that is a really hard and fast limitation. And so there are a couple things you can do. You could try to break that idea down into smaller ideas. And I'm going to address it in the way of research, about which I know just a touch because my wife's a doctor who does a little bit of research. But let me put it in the form of music first. For me, that has meant writing on piano, talking to some people who might be interested, working with a guitarist, eventually finding a drummer, little bit by little bit. In the way of a research project, my guess would be that each of those pieces become their own creative quests along the way. But by seeing them as a whole, it does become, it goes from staring at Base Camp 4 to looking at Everest. And you can't really get to Everest, or you can't get to the summit without getting to Base Camp 1. And in that respect, I'd say this becomes an organizational problem. Is the caller still there?
No, off the line.
I'd wonder if that addresses him or just infuriates him.
Hopefully it helps. We're talking to Matt Richtel, talking about how to be creative. You wrote a section on that for the New York Times' Year of Living Better series. Matt, you mentioned kids earlier, and they have the creative idea. How can parents, you know, resist that urge to say, no, that's goofy, and you know, let that creative process take wing?
I'm so glad you asked that, and it's something else I've written about. And I sometimes go talk at schools, and I use a simple exercise that I call What If. And the exercise is aimed both at the kids and the adults, and it starts by let's say you take your kids and you say, let's play a game called What If, and they get to fill in the What If. Here's the test for the parents. When the kid, as they once said to me, in a kindergarten classroom, says, what if I flushed the toilet and I went to outer space? Instead of saying, well, we don't really do potty talk in school, I said, now that would blow my mind. Hey, what if? And then I said to the next kid, what if you flushed the toilet, you went into outer space? And then the next kid had a what if that followed. The point of this is both to give the kids an exercise that is totally open-ended. Let them follow the string of what if. And I've gone into classrooms and we'll write stories that follow one what if for the next. But the challenge for the parents is to stop yourself from saying that's a good idea or a bad idea. Because when that happens, you begin to wall off that voice later on in life.
Matt, we have about 30. I'm going to give you 30 seconds here. Give us an inspiration to be creative tonight.
To be creative tonight. This is a simple one I talked about, I think, with your producer. I find that the simplest way to get into this is before you go to sleep at night, at least I, and I know many other people, think about all kinds of things. We have fantasies. When I was a kid, my fantasy was, it's kind of dark, but I was protecting my family from bad guys in a hut. And I would think about that. That is a quiet moment where there's an idea. I would challenge your listeners before bed to honor the things that they think about. I don't know if it's meeting someone new or a business idea or a story they tell themselves. Just listen to that, not because that's the idea they're going to pursue, but because that's the habit of listening to yourself in a quiet moment.
We'll leave it there. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Matt Richtel, author, cartoonist, and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at the New York Times. He wrote the section on how to be creative for the New York Times, A Year of Living Better series. He joined us to talk about where creativity and ideas come from and to offer some inspiration, too. You can share your creativity stories still over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. A question for you. Are you a collector? And if so, of what? Please call the Ideas Network hotline. The number is 833-42-IDEAS. That's 833-42-IDEAS or numerically 833-424-3327. 833-424-3327. Now, why would I ask you something like that? Well, we're going to talk about collecting on this show coming up on Thursday. And this is something I've always been kind of curious about, and one of the producers wanted to pursue this idea. A lot of people collect a lot of different stuff, a lot of different things, and I've always been curious why people collect the things they do. What makes them choose that or stumble into it? How do you get started, and how far do you run with it? I collect board games myself. I don't really think of myself as a collector because, you know, I try to play them. I don't take particularly good care of them. They're not in mint condition unless you want to buy one from me. Then they're in perfect condition, great condition. I want to know what you collect, how you got started, how big your collection is, what you do with it. Again, call into the Ideas Network hotline, leave a message. We'll hopefully play some of those on the show as we talk about collecting on Thursday. The number is 833-424-3327. Look forward to hearing from you here on Central Time.